This is First Instar, written by Astrea215 and read by Flower Parish. This is an Old Guard movie fic, rated for general audiences, featuring the relationship Niall Freeman and Joe/Yusuf Al-Kazani. Summary. What do you talk about with a 1,000-year-old man when you've just discovered you're immortal yourself, after you've questioned his interior decorating, that is? If you're Niall Freeman and the man is Yusuf Al-Kazani, you might start with art history. Author's notes. Instar. The developmental stage of arthropods between each molt. The first instar is the stage between hatching and the first molt. Arthropods must shed their exoskeleton in order to grow or change into a new form.
I dedicate my life to something richer and all the things that come, 'cause that's no price at all, and I know you need it, and I want you to know.
Copley offered to find them accommodations, both comfortable and safe, where they could rest, and Andy could heal. Andy had a different idea, though. "We'll go our own way," she said. "In a month, come meet us." "Meet you where?" he asked, visibly apprehensive. Andy grinned, and Niall suddenly understood in a very visceral way why writers described certain smiles as wolfish. "If you're as good as you need to be," Andy said, "you'll find us. And if you're not that good, we need to know sooner rather than later." Which is how Niall ended up in Hungary a week later, so exhausted, disoriented, and brain-fogged that she remembered only vague details of how she'd gotten there. Joe puttered around the courtyard until he found the pot that the caretaker had left the key in, while she stared numbly up at the door. The three steps up into the house took the very last of her energy, and though she knew Joe wanted to show her around and welcome her properly, it was all she could do to stumble to the nearest bedroom before faceplanting on the bed. After a solid 12 hours of sleep, she felt more human. "Am I still human?" she asked herself, and immediately pushed the thought away. The journey from England had been so stressful. "I'm a Marine, not a spy," she'd complained, that she really hadn't had any of what could be called quality time with Joe. Getting the house tidied up and provisioned to Joe's satisfaction didn't necessarily count either, but it helped to have something concrete to do. Except there was surprisingly little needing to be done. The plants, in pots around the door and scattered around the backyard, were neglected. The bedrooms needed airing and dusting. The refrigerator was empty, and the pantry had only a few random cans. It took a day and a half to address everything, at what was, for Niall, a leisurely pace. And conversation about anything other than their immediate situation was fraught and full of pitfalls. They were both grieving their families, unwilling to poke at fresh wounds, but unable to think about anything else. Delving into his history seemed to always end with either a scowl and an abrupt subject change, if the story involved Booker, or a sigh and a silent, aching grief that she couldn't bear to see, if the story involved Andy. He told her a few anecdotes that were just about him and Nikki, but even those seemed a little off. She realized that they were supposed to be duets, and Joe wasn't used to telling them solo. Questions about her life were painful reminders of what she'd lost, and somehow she was more reluctant to share with Joe than she'd been with Andy and Booker. Maybe because they both carried their own grief so close to the surface. For Joe, grief seemed like an unwelcome stranger rather than an old companion. There were a lot of uncomfortable silences. So she was rather proud when it occurred to her that she could ask about the house itself beyond the required chores. The color scheme had been at the front of her thoughts since she woke up there. Inside and out, the walls were almost all yellow, ranging from a soft butter shade in the kitchen to an aggressive goldenrod in one of the bedrooms. While they made up the bed for Andy in the goldenrod room, she brought it up and his face lit up as bright as the paint. The story he told about how he and Nikki had acquired the house made her laugh until she cried. "How much time do you get to spend here?" she asked, after she sat on the bed and caught her breath. "Does it just sit here empty while you're gone?" She'd gotten the impression they moved around a lot, but she didn't really know what their lives looked like when they weren't on the run. She wondered how long it would be before she got to see it for herself. "Not as much as we'd like," Joe said, sitting down next to her. "And no, not at all. Too wasteful and too conspicuous. There are people in town that we trust, and they see to it that anyone who needs a place to stay for a bit can make a home here. People flying under the radar, as they say. Dissidents, refugees, migrants. If it hadn't been available now, we'd have picked somewhere else to meet." That sounded noble and all, but why would refugees need to fly under the radar? He looked at her quizzically, as if doubting she was serious, and then more intensely, with an expression she couldn't read. She found herself instinctively wanting to stand at attention, like she was being inspected. The cheer she'd worked so hard for vanished from the atmosphere. After a long moment, Joe looked away, face still indecipherable. He slapped his thighs and stood. "Well, I guess you'll have plenty of time to catch up on the news now." She'd started to relax when he turned from her, but she stiffened again, this time in indignation. "Hey, I keep up with the news." He raised a skeptical eyebrow. "The American news." This time she did stand up. "I wasn't in America when Andy kidnapped me, remember? I bet I know a lot more about Afghan politics than you do. Sorry if I'm not an expert on everything everywhere. I've been a little busy." His mouth opened and closed, and he swiveled minutely as if he was torn between talking to her and leaving the room. Then he faced her decisively. "Busy doing what, exactly?" She wasn't about to take criticism from someone who killed as easily and prolifically as he did. He wasn't the one having nightmares every night, only some of which were Quinn. "There are girls going to school now because of us. There are people with access to drinking water and medical care. People get to vote. Making the world safe for democracy? That's disingenuous at best. Do you really think the Bush administration..." He cut himself off and took a deep breath, drawing all that anger back into himself. "No, sorry, I didn't mean to start a fight." "Yeah, well..." Her blood was up, and she wasn't prepared to let it go so easily. "My dad died there. He was a Marine too. Just so you know, if you've got something you want to say about my father, go ahead and say it." He didn't rise to the bait. In fact, his face fell. With an expression of sincere heartbreak, he said, "Two generations caught in the same conflict. I'm so sorry for your losses, Niall." Losses, plural. Her mind returned, as it so often did, to the image of two purple hearts on her mother's mantle, two gold stars on the collar of her mother's black dress. Without another word, she walked past him and headed for her room. A minute later, she heard footsteps approach and pause outside her closed door. Then they moved away and went slowly, heavily up the stairs. She woke late that night, gasping and choking. Before she'd even fully registered that she was safe and dry in the yellow house, she was on her feet and headed for Joe. She needed not to be alone. She needed another human presence to ground her. Just as she was about to step onto the stairs, she heard it. A hollow, muffled sound. And then another. She froze. Joe was crying. "Does he want company? Does he want to be left alone? Why is it me here instead of Nikki or Andy?" In the end, she went back to bed and stared at the ceiling until the sun came up. The next morning at breakfast, he was warm, cheerful, and solicitous. She didn't think she looked any different, but he seemed to see right away that she hadn't slept well. "You know," he said, "if you have another dream about Quinn and need to process it, you can always come upstairs and get me, or for any other reason. Just because we're sleeping in separate rooms now doesn't mean you have to deal with things alone." She wondered if he knew she'd heard him. "Oh, well, thanks. but I wouldn't want to disturb you. He waved a hand dismissively. Don't worry about that at all. You certainly don't have to talk to me about anything if you don't want to, but you can. Okay, I'll keep that in mind. He pursed his lips and gave her a look of such deep skepticism that she had to laugh, even as she guessed that the performance was covering up real concern. I will, I really will. Thank you. A few minutes of companionable silence later, she asked if he had any updates on when Andy and Nikki would be joining them. Tired of me already? He asked with a wink, inviting her to join in the joke, but once again she thought maybe he meant it a little bit. I just thought it might be easier for you with Nikki here. You might be less, you know, tense, not as worried. He laughed ruefully. I'm always happier with Nikki than without him, but the one I'm worried about is Andy. He fiddled with his fork and frowned down at his plate. I'm not used to worrying about her. It's unsettling. There it was again, the sigh and the haunted look. She considered that maybe she wasn't the only one having nightmares every night. How do you even try to comfort a 1,000-year-old man? She tried telling herself that it wasn't her job to comfort him, that if anyone needed comfort, it was her. We could comfort each other, maybe. But she'd known him for barely 2 weeks. Someday. Not today, but someday. He forced a smile and said, Hey, how'd you like to walk over to Debrecen Plaza and hit up the mall for some new clothes? Just because you're close to Andy's size doesn't mean you're limited to whatever she's got stashed around. We've got the money, and you have the air of someone it would be fun to shop with. I think I'd like that a lot, actually. Okay, good. He smiled softly and started eating again. Good. Andy showed up 2 days later, unexpectedly and in the middle of the night. After Joe yelled at her, first about did she want to get shot again, startling them all like that, and then about how the hell was he supposed to hug her with a gut wound, he did noticeably relax. He relaxed even further when Nikki joined them. But what really turned things around, from Niall's point of view, was when Nikki showed her the secret compartment in the cellar. We don't really like keeping weapons in a house that other people will be living in, he explained, but we also do not like being unprepared. So this is our compromise. I'm surprised Joe did not bring you here immediately. She shrugged. He was pretty distracted the first few days, and I can't say knowing there was a hidden stash of guns would have made me feel better. What are these? She pulled out a small stack of books tucked into the corner. Oh, Joe's sketchbooks. He will be happy to see those. Niall had already flipped the first one open, and Nikki didn't seem inclined to take them away from her, so she considered that permission to keep looking. These are amazing, Nikki. I had no idea he could do this. And these are just sketches he leaves lying around? If I drew anything this good, it would be framed. I'd show everyone. And he has books full of this. I used to try to keep all his drawings. Materials were harder to get, then, and each one was precious. But our lives are not kind to fragile things. Now paper is cheap, disposable. Everything he makes is still precious to me, but I am less attached to them all individually when there are so many. And of course, he has had a great deal of practice. There are paintings of his in some of our other houses, a few sculptures. He's tried every medium he knows of, I think. But drawing is the most portable, something he can do anywhere. So that's what he's done most. That evening, as she and Joe washed the dishes after dinner, she casually said, Hey, did I ever tell you I wanted to major in art history? There were very few silences between them after that. Andy had one last trick she wanted to try with Copley. As the last few days of their agreed-upon month ticked by, she started sending them all out on day trips. To obscure the trail a little, she said. On Tuesday, she took Niall an hour north to spend the day at the zoo, while Nikki and Joe headed northeast for something they called a cave bath. Niall was not inclined to ask for details. Wednesday, Niall went hiking through the marshes of a massive nearby park with Nikki and Joe, while Andy took off on her own. Wednesday night, Niall asked, "Hey, can I have Joe to myself tomorrow?" For an instant, he looked surprised and gratified, as though he hadn't expected that she would want any more time alone with him. After that, he just looked smug. He leaned back in his chair with his arms folded behind his head. "Do you hear that, everyone? I have been specially requested." To Niall, he said, "You may most certainly have me all to yourself. What did you have in mind?" "I was thinking about the Museum of Fine Art in Budapest." Coming up out of the underground parking garage felt very symbolic in a Greek mythology way, emerging from the underworld and back to light and life. And to reckon she was in hiding, part of a secret group of immortals laying low. In Budapest, she was just a tourist. She didn't have to be anything other than what she looked like, a young woman visiting a foreign country and excited to be there. Of course, one of the reasons she was excited was wholly unique to her situation. She found herself grinning, and if Heroes Square hadn't been so crowded, she probably would have run all the way across it and up the museum steps. As it was, she bounced on the balls of her feet while waiting in line at the ticket counter, a habit she'd thought she'd grown out of. Joe eyed her fondly. "You're really looking forward to this." "I really am." As soon as it was their turn, she surged forward and said, "Two tickets to the permanent exhibition, please," in what Joe promised her was excellent Hungarian. She'd spent most of the drive practicing museum-specific phrases to supplement the basic, "Where is the bathroom?" and "How much does this cost?" vocabulary she'd already learned over the past few weeks. The woman behind the counter smiled and asked, in English, "Would you like an audio guide as well?" Joe opened his mouth, but before he could speak, Niall said, "No, thank you," to the woman, and then, smugly to Joe, "We definitely don't need that." "We don't." But he didn't push. He waited until she'd paid for their tickets and they were moving across the entrance hall before he followed up. "So why don't we need an audio guide? I thought it was a nice idea." She looked at him doubtfully, and then, with growing suspicion when he showed no sign of joking, "Why would we need their guide when we've got you?" "Me? I'm no museum docent. What made you think I could be a tour guide?" "Well, you're, you know." He grinned. "Preternaturally charming, fiendishly clever, devilishly handsome." "No, no, and no." She talked right over his offended protest. "Come on, you were there. You know all this. I'm not asking you to tell me about their patrons or classical illusions or whatever. I want the dirt, the behind-the-scenes details, the stuff the museum people will never know." "Niall. Niall, I don't know those things." She skidded to a halt. "You what?" "I have no dirt on any of the pieces in this museum." Niall blinked at him a few times. Then she grabbed his arm, hurried him into the enormous Renaissance hall, and dragged him behind one of the rectangular pillars, where they could at least pretend to have some privacy. "What do you mean you don't know anything about the art here?" Joe shrugged, nonplussed. "I mean, I don't know anything. Well, I know some things, obviously. I could tell you plenty about their classical illusions, as a matter of fact, as well as their technique. But you've studied art history. You probably know a lot of it yourself." She stared at him, jaw slack with shock, until she pulled herself back together and pointed a shaking finger up at the balcony overlooking the hall. "There is an exhibit of European art up there, covering more than 500 years, and you're telling me there's not one painter you can gossip about, not a single affair, or fight, or anything?" "I don't know what to tell you, Niall. We were busy with other things. In a few hundred years, when you're talking to the newest one of us, and they ask if you knew Banksy, what are you going to say? But that's not. She looked around, aware that some things should not be said too loudly in a museum. She moved closer to him and hissed, Andy has a Rodin in a cave. She does, and I'm as indignant about it as you are. But that's an exception, and I'm not Andy. Her face fell, and he tried to cheer her up. Nikki and I met Keith Haring at a fundraiser once, if that helps. I know it's not quite the same. Niall? She shook herself and lifted her chin. It's fine. You've got plenty of other stories. Let's go back and see if we can upgrade to the audio tour. The car ride back started with a return of the awkwardness from the first few days in Hungary. When they were out of the city, Joe tried to address it. So, do you want to talk about it? Niall stared off into the distance, her head resting on the passenger side window. There's nothing to talk about. I made some dumb assumptions, that's all. You made some assumptions, but they were not dumb. She rolled her eyes. Did he have to sound so much like a school counselor? Niall, this is... You've had so much thrown at you in such a short period of time. I want you to feel like you can ask questions, no matter how silly you think they are. He gave her a sly, sideways look. Nikki asked Andy if she'd known Jesus. That got her to sit up. Did she? He laughed, but it was so clearly not at her that she didn't feel embarrassed. She did not. She and Quinn and Lycon weren't anywhere near Judea. They didn't swing through the Mediterranean until the 3rd or 4th century, and they were very confused. I bet. So? Okay, fine. You really didn't know any artists? He kept his eyes on the road, but she saw his eyebrows shoot up his forehead. I've known more artists than I can count, just not any of the ones in that museum. Okay, yes, that's a very Eurocentric approach to art history, I get that. But if we went to a museum somewhere else, like, I mean any museum. Maybe somewhere out there is a folk art exhibit with something I'd recognize. That's not impossible. But an artist anyone has heard of? No, there's no one. Niall shook her head. She'd been so sure, after the Rodin. Had he and Nikki really spent the past 900 years just fighting? It hadn't seemed like it the past few weeks. They all seemed fine with domesticity, happy even. Andy, too, which had been surprising at first. She'd imagined them in jazz clubs and speakeasies and salons and ballrooms. Just because Joe doesn't know any famous painters doesn't mean he never had any fun, she told herself sternly, but the dread was creeping back in. What is my life going to be like? Is there anyone you wish you'd met? Near misses you're kicking yourself over. Near misses? Yeah, like... Damn, if we'd gotten there a year earlier, we could have met Rembrandt. That kind of thing. Not really, no. People like Rembrandt didn't need us. But you're not on missions all the time, right? I don't mean jobs, not that kind of need. Michelangelo, Rembrandt, Picasso, all of them, they didn't need us to be remembered. Which means... What is it that most people want from their lives? Safety, yes, happiness... but also to feel like they've made a difference. They want something of who they were to live on after them. We can't share our immortality, and we can't make people happy, but we can keep them safe, and we can carry them with us so that some part of them lives on. 200 years ago, there was an old Russian peasant who carved little wooden animals. They weren't especially beautiful or technically proficient. It was just something to keep busy during the winter. He'd whittle these little guys, owls and dogs and deer, very ordinary animals, and half the time he'd just toss them in the fire afterward without even showing them to anyone. No one knows his name anymore. Maybe some of his descendants are still around. Maybe there's a tree he planted. Maybe not. But there's nothing left of his carvings, no evidence anywhere in the world that he made them, except that I remember them. And it's more than just memory. We were in Argentina at the turn of the century, not this one, the last one, and you have not lived until you've seen Andy Tango. Everyone who's danced with her since then, no matter how many years or miles away, has learned something from the people who taught her. Whores and sailors and dock workers and tavern musicians, and maybe no one thought they mattered at the time, but they still have an influence 100 years later. Nikki and I still make tadka the way this one Punjabi auntie taught us. She's long gone, but she's still feeding people. That board Copley showed us, that's important. But whatever it is that makes us immortal, whether or not there's some kind of intelligence or consciousness behind it, I don't think that's the only thing we're here for. We're not just killing machines, we're time capsules. We bear witness, and we remember. And I believe that matters. What if that's not enough? You're talking about it like it's some noble thing, but to me it just sounds lonely. To be the only one that remembers something. To lose so much and only have memories left. But you won't be the only one. That's why we have each other, to help carry the weight of all of this. We'll teach you Makidal, and you'll teach us what you want to remember. And when that new immortal asks you about Banksy, you'll tell them all about a street artist you met on Alpha Centauri. Alpha Centauri? He grinned. Or wherever. But we keep it all going. It can be a celebration, not an elegy. She still thought it sounded awful, and he must have seen that on her face. That's what works for me, anyway. You'll find your own reason. And when that stops serving you, you'll find another one. And if I never do? You're going to live a very long time, Niall. I don't think there's anything you'll never do. The good things and the bad things. Things you can't even imagine right now. How much of my life today would even be comprehensible to who I was after my first month? You'll figure it out eventually. But what if... Niall. He sounded harsher than she'd ever heard him since leaving London. She startled a bit, and he reined himself in. If you learn nothing else from the events when you first met us, I want you to learn that you can only endure. There are no outs. There are no shortcuts. There is just this life that is going to continue for a long, long time. Everything will pass, eventually. Good times will end, and you'll feel that loss, but bad times will end too. Whatever happens, you will get through it, because you will have no choice. You're scared and confused right now, but one day you won't be, and then something will happen to make you scared and confused again. The only thing I can promise you is that however you feel, it won't last forever. What if doesn't mean anything? You'll always have another chance. A life like he described was too much to conceive of. She didn't even try. She focused on something more immediate instead. You keep doing that, starting to get mad and then holding back. You don't have to. Niall, I know I'm just a baby to you, but I'm actually a grown woman, a pretty tough grown woman. Whatever you throw at me, I can take it. Oh, believe me, I have very great respect for your toughness and your grownness. You're new, you're young, you're not a kid. So go for it. Just because you can take it doesn't mean you should have to. You being tough doesn't preclude my choosing to be gentle. It doesn't mean you don't deserve for people to be gentle with you sometimes. It's not about fragility, it's about decency, kindness. Besides, I think we both know it's not you I'm actually mad at. It's never been you. There it was, the elephant in the room. You can be mad at both of us. I know. I'm not, though. Not even though I thought he should just apologize. I'm not going to get angry at you for trying to be kind. I can disagree with you. I can think you're misguided, dangerously so. See, you're getting mad right now. I am not. His laugh, though a bit hollow, was real. Nikki would say that my passion sometimes short-circuits my volume control. Whoa, TMI, man. What? Oh, no. I mean, raising my voice doesn't mean I'm angry. It just means I care a lot. I get it. I brought a white friend to Thanksgiving once. She about had a panic attack, everybody getting loud and talking over each other and then getting louder. But that was just us having a good time. Exactly. So, dangerously misguided, huh? He shrugged. You know how Nikki and I met. Dangerously misguided isn't unforgivable. But Nikki changed his mind, right? What if I don't? Then I'll keep disagreeing with you. Or, who knows, maybe one day I'll change my mind. But disagreeing isn't a bad thing, and nothing is so bad that I'd just write you off. He swallowed thickly. Do you understand what I'm saying? I'm sure it looks different to you right now. You don't get the scale of things. But even 100 years isn't forever. If you're wondering, what the hell did I do? I gave up my old life for people who won't have my back. We will. I promise you. Always. She didn't have much to say to that. And, at the same time, she had too much. She let her head fall back against the window, and this time the silence was a lot more comfortable. For her, anyway. Joe made it about 5 minutes before he started humming to himself. The humming gradually shifted to singing under his breath, and then fully out loud. She wondered if he even realized he'd done it. His voice was, well, it wasn't the best she'd ever heard. She thought she'd done a good job of hiding her reactions, but he must have seen her wince at a particularly sour note. He was gracious about it, at least. Recorded music has only been around for what, a century or so? Before that, if you wanted a song, someone near you had to sing it. And I'm pretty sure that, in all of human history, more people have sounded like me than Mariah Carey. It's not about being good, it's like cooking. Not everyone is amazing at it, but you've got to eat, right? And whatever it is, it's better than not eating. When you're crossing the Karakoram and you're days away from any kind of settlement, and it's just you and your horses and the people you've been traveling with for years already, any song from any singer is better than nothing. He started singing again, in a language she didn't recognize, and Niall closed her eyes and tried to imagine it. A campfire at night. Andy and an indistinct figure with long dark hair, turning meat on a spit. Nikki sharpening his sword. And Joe singing. This is the same, she thought. What they listened to back then is exactly what I'm listening to now. She could almost hear the crackling of the fire, almost smell the roasting meat. For a moment, she could almost grasp what it meant to be as old as they were, and to carry all those memories. Then Joe exclaimed as a car whipped around them going far too fast, and her eyes snapped open, and the moment was gone. She couldn't recapture it, even though Joe kept going for over an hour. But it was a comfort to her to think that maybe something about this crazy new life might be comprehensible after all. When Joe's voice finally gave out, she applauded. I used to be able to go for longer than that, he said hoarsely. You see what music on demand has done. I'm out of practice. I guess you'll have to keep doing it then. He grinned. Does that mean my singing no longer offends your delicate sensibilities? Niall pretended to give this serious thought, humming softly while stroking her chin. I'm not sure. You know how with a bad smell, it's terrible at first, but eventually you stop noticing it. He laughed, and she was pleased that she'd read the situation correctly. She wasn't sure how well you could get to know a millennium-old person in just a few weeks, and she'd already learned that she didn't know him as well as she'd thought. Making Joe laugh had turned out to be pretty easy, but she felt proud of herself every time anyway. Then, still chuckling, he shoved her shoulder, hard enough to push her into the car door, and she suddenly missed her brother so much it hurt. She said to Joe what she'd have said to him in the same situation. Hey, no fair. I can't hit you back when you're driving. Do your worst, he said cheerfully. I've driven through earthquakes and blizzards and aerial bombardments. You think you're more dangerous than that? He poked her side, making her squawk, and with instincts honed by over 2 decades of siblinghood, she grabbed the offending finger before he could withdraw it. Casually, voice at odds with the strength of her grip, she asked, So what happens if we lose a body part? Does it regrow? Can we reattach it? Joe tugged against her hold a few times and chuckled. All right, I take it back. You are definitely more dangerous than an earthquake. When she still didn't relent, he said, May I ransom my hand back with information? Go on. He dropped his voice to a stage whisper. Don't tell her I told you this. But if you catch Andy in the right mood, you might get to hear some of her vast repertoire of epic poetry. She let go of his hand like she'd just realized he was holding dynamite. Seriously? Oh, yes. By the time Andy encountered the concept of writing, she was already older than I am now. Niall felt dizzy just thinking about that. Maybe she wasn't so close to comprehending immortality after all. Joe didn't seem to notice. He went on. Her whole approach to retaining information is different. Poems and songs and stories, she has to keep them all up here. He tapped his temple. But she's forgotten so much, I thought. Not nearly all of it, and some things are easier to retain than others. Niall nodded thoughtfully, sincerely this time. That makes sense. My junior year English teacher made us memorize the first part of the prologue of the Canterbury Tales, in Middle English, to the tune of Yankee Doodle. I always said it would be stuck in my head till the day I died, and you know, even if that's thousands of years from now, I think that still might be true. Joe laughed so hard that he almost swerved out of their lane. It was night when they reached the Yellow House, like it had been when she and Joe first arrived. But this time, the courtyard was swept, there were lights on, and it looked something like home. They rounded the curve of the little drive up to the garage, and there was an unfamiliar car parked there. Niall tensed and instinctively reached for the glove compartment, where Joe had stashed a gun. But Joe was laughing and pointing to the dining room window and the figures moving behind the glass. "Nikki owes Andy 40,000 forints," he said. "It's Copley." The end. Podfigures note, this was potted for 429 car crash as a summer podfic swap main gift. I'm going to pod this and also the like sequel attached fic thing that was gifted to you. Thank you for helping me discover these fics. They're so wonderful, and I really hope you enjoy this podfic.